Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Biden administration's decision to support easing patent rules, which has Big Pharma alarmed and is already getting pushback from countries like Germany. Joining us is Thomas Boyke, Director of the Global Health Program and a Senior Fellow for Global Health Economics and Development at the Council on Foreign Relations, who was also a Professor of Law at Georgetown University and the Founder and Managing Editor of Think Global Health. We will discuss efforts by South Africa and India, countries which are suffering the ravages of the pandemic and only have 1 or 2% of their population vaccinated, to get waivers on patents so they can produce drugs and vaccines that are affordable. But even though India has licensing agreements for most of the vaccines on the market, including Russia's Sputnik, there is a shortage of the precursors needed to mass produce vaccines, and so far the richer countries have gotten the lion's share of them. Then we'll look into the bill to make voting difficult for Democrats and easier for Republicans in the key swing state of Florida that was signed today by Governor DeSantis in a ceremony which excluded the press except for Fox News. Joining us is Charles Zeldin, a professor in the Department of Humanities and Politics at Nova Southeastern University's Halmus College of Arts and Sciences in Florida, who is an expert on voting rights and the author of Voting Rights on Trial and The Battle for the Black Ballot, Smith v. Allwright, and the Defeat of the Texas All-White Primary. We will discuss how this ambitious and increasingly authoritarian governor is Trump's favorite to run as his VP in 2024, even though it is against the law for two candidates from the same state to be on the same ticket. Then finally, we'll speak with David Rothkopf, the producer of the podcast National Security Magazine and Deep State Radio, which he hosts, and a columnist for The Daily Beast and USA Today. His latest book is Traitor, A History of American Betrayal from Benedict Arnold to Donald Trump, and we will discuss how a federal judge is demanding that the Department of Justice hand over documents the former Attorney General kept secret, which implicate Barr in misleading her and the Congress about how he spun the Mueller report's findings. We'll also discuss new revelations in the British press that there was a second Steele dossier produced for the FBI during Trump's term that contains raw intelligence, which makes further claims of Russian meddling in the U.S. election and also references claims regarding the existence of further Trump sex tapes. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org, as either the Pacifica Network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now is Thomas Boyke, who's a director of the Global Health Program and a senior fellow for Global Health, Economics, and Development at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's also a professor of law at Georgetown University and the author of Plagues and the Paradox of Progress, Why the World is Getting Healthier in Worrisome Ways, as well as the founder and managing editor of Think Global Health, an online magazine that examines the way health shapes economic societies and everyday lives around the world. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Boyke.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, thanks for joining us. And what do you make of the Biden administration's decision? It's a pretty serious one to support the easing of patents rules on COVID-19 vaccines. There's already an enormous amount of pushback coming from Big Pharma and from countries like Germany. It's not a done deal, but so far, how does it strike you?
So I think the move is a cause for optimism, provided it is the signals the beginning, not the end, of U.S. efforts to expand global manufacturing to respond to this pandemic. There's no question that there's the need. 5 months into the rollout of these vaccines. We've administered more than 1.2 billion doses worldwide, but just 9 nations are responsible for 3 out of every 4 doses administered. And as we've seen tragically over the last few weeks, countries that had been having reasonable success in containing this pandemic are now suffering devastating resurgences like India, Nepal, and Uruguay, all which have lacked adequate vaccine supplies to administer. So it's responding to a need. It's just not on its own sufficient to do so.
Well, obviously, the virus does not respect national boundaries or international boundaries. And even though President Biden is quite optimistic that he'll get 70% of the adults in this country vaccinated by July the 4th, it sort of doesn't matter, does it, Thomas, if you've got South Africa with only 1% of people vaccinated, India, I think it's a little over 2% now, and they're having horrendous death toll there. If the whole world is not vaccinated, this damn virus is going to live on and mutate and get more dangerous, isn't it?
That's exactly right. It will. And we're already seeing that. That's in part what's driving the increase, many believe, in India. The development of a new variant that's more contagious has been seen as one of the potential drivers of what is happening there and in the region, and to some extent also in Latin America. This can undo all the good progress that we've worked so hard for in the United States, in part because there are still many Americans, even older Americans, who are not yet vaccinated in this country, because they've been slow to seek vaccination in some cases. And we it may be that we develop new variants that are resistant to the vaccines that we've administered. So we have every interest, humanitarian, moral, but also just frankly self-interest in trying to ensure the world is better vaccinated.
But all the work that's being done and the success that is being done here in the United States and the optimism that President Biden has of getting 70% of adults inoculated by July the 4th, that could be all out the window if more virulent strains develop in other countries where there isn't any vaccination or very little going on. And these more virulent strains will eventually make their way back to the United States. And the vaccines that we have, whether they're the more effective ones, Moderna and Pfizer, may prove to be inadequate.
That's right. So the emergence of variants is going to increase the demands on global vaccine manufacturing for a couple of reasons. One, as you suggested, it may be the vaccines that we have now are not sufficiently effective against those new variants, in which case we will need second generation vaccines or maybe a booster shot to increase individuals' immunity against these new variants. Also, if these variants are more contagious, it means you need to vaccinate a greater number of people in the population to have the same public health effect that you would otherwise. The last reason we need to increase vaccine supplies in response to the variants is the only effective way, really, to get ahead of these variants, as you suggested, Ian, globally, is by increasing vaccination. These variants emerge naturally with the increased spread of this virus. The more people that get infected, the more likely you'll have variants. The only way to break that chain is through increased global vaccination.
And again, I'm speaking with Thomas Boyke. He's a director of Global Health Program and Senior Fellow for Global Health Economics and Development at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's also a professor of law at Georgetown University and the author of Plagues and the Paradox of Progress, Why the World is Getting Healthier in Worrisome Ways, as well as the founder and managing editor of Think Global Health, an online magazine that examines the ways health shapes economics, societies, and everyday lives around the world. So how much did the fact that President Trump, apart from his disastrous mishandling of COVID in this country, because the only way to really defeat it is to hit it hard and fast early, otherwise it does begin to mutate. And it's always been a race between vaccination and mutation. And we're talking about the possibility that we're globally, we're going to lose in this race. But one of the things that Trump did, along with all of the other disastrous things like telling us to drink bleach and other ridiculous things, was cutting us off from the WHO. Could the WHO have created, or does it have the clout to create a kind of global regime so that everybody on the planet gets vaccinated? Or is this patent issue that's now before us the main barrier?
So, to be fair to the World Health Organization, they've tried. They have stood up a multilateral initiative known as COVAX to try to vaccinate the world. It's intended by the end of 2021 to vaccinate 20% of the people in each country in the world. So far, they have only administered around 40 million doses of vaccine worldwide, and they had anticipated administering 2 billion doses by the end of the year. The problem is they are short supplies. Supplies were bought up by wealthy nations, including the United States. And to the extent that COVAX has invested in its own manufacturing of vaccines, that has been undermined because they cannot get all the things you need to make vaccine, like the raw materials, the equipment, the components, the syringes, the tubing, everything along the process that they've been short of. And here, too, to some degree, it is the fact that the U.S. and European nations have prioritized their own domestic needs for those supplies. So they can't make them. Patents play a role in here, but I want to be clear that it's, frankly, just a component of a larger process. India, which is the most short of vaccines, has 3 out of 5 of the Western vaccines have already licensed production in India. J&J, AstraZeneca, and Novavax have all licensed production in India. So has the Russian vaccine producer. The challenge is they just don't have the supplies ultimately to make it. So this is why I say that a waiver can do some good, but only if the U.S. stands up a broader effort to increase the supplies and scale up manufacturing along the lines of what we have done with our allies in the past around HIV.
And India, of course, is one of the world's largest producer of vaccines. So what you've just told us is that they've got the license to produce a number of these vaccines, except, I guess, for Pfizer, they've got all the other ones, including Sputnik, the Russian one. So that's the problem. There's a global shortage of the precursors. So what can be done about the global shortage of the precursors?
So what we could do is we could do what we did domestically. And as you rightly pointed out, there are many things, a long, long list, longer than we have together, of what went wrong in the last administration in the response to the coronavirus. One thing that is a positive, though, has been the effort to scale up financing and policy support of the government to build the supply chains that vaccine manufacturing needs to succeed. So Operation Warp Speed didn't just pay a lot of money for finished vaccines. They matched manufacturers with suppliers. They subsidized all along the supply chain. They coordinated between those suppliers and monitored progress and troubleshot where they could. And that is why we've been able, so successful in this country, what was done under that effort under the last administration and is being done currently under this administration to scale up that production. We need to see a similar effort, a global Operation Warp Speed of sorts, to operate internationally. Small market countries, and I mean by small, the size of the pharmaceutical market, cannot stand up this kind of production in each country alone. It's not a matter of sophistication of the countries. It's frankly a matter of resources and the size of the market. We need countries to work together to do that. We need the same kind of global initiatives we saw around HIV, but for this pandemic.
So then what is the point of overriding patents and basically breaking that kind of intellectual property compact that many people, you know, we've been beating up on the Chinese because of their stealing IP. So IP's become a kind of sacred cow, particularly on Wall Street. And by the way, pharmaceutical stocks have taken a hit. Moderna was down 2.1 after falling as low as 12% earlier. So why do it if it's a case in India where they've already got the licensing?
So ultimately, what we the benefits of the waiver are that it creates a potential incentive and simplifies the means by which manufacturers globally can respond to this pandemic. One way of explaining that is through an analogy. So in 2001, at the World Trade Organization, there was a declaration issued around the fact that countries could leverage the flexibilities under that agreement in a public health emergency. So they could do things like license the patent without the permission of its patent holder in order to make more vaccine domestically to respond to a crisis. That didn't create new powers for manufacturers, but what it did is it created a incentive for manufacturers in the developing world, for governments, and frankly, for donors to work together on responding the underlying concerns that that declaration represented. We could see something like that on this waiver, but again, only if it operates as part of a larger program of investment by the U.S. and its allies to respond to the need for global manufacturing of vaccines.
So just in closing, the U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy said that the vaccine waiver proposal puts people over patents. Could this lead to a broader movement to limit the extension of patents, for example? I mean, when companies like Pfizer make a fortune out of Viagra, they extend the patents and make billions extra, and a lot of important drugs are held off the market because of patent extensions. And this means that cheaper generic drugs aren't available. And we've heard lots and lots of stories about some specialized cancer drugs costing thousands and thousands of dollars a tablet. I mean, so could this Biden proposal kind of be breaking that dam?
So it could, and that's certainly what the intention is. The proposed waiver that was put forward by South Africa and India, the two sponsors of it, is incredibly broad. It applies not just to vaccines, it applies to drugs and diagnostics. And the initial proposal was that it would last for as long as it takes for a majority of the world to get immunity against this virus, which, because of the variants we talked about earlier, may never happen. So it is, frankly, a shot directly at the patent system and how it applies to pharmaceuticals. And there you have mixed emotions about that, because on one hand, there are the concerns that you represented about whether or not pricing of pharmaceuticals is fair and the kind of profits we see in this pandemic are justified despite, you know, the fast development of very good vaccines. The issue, though, is if we are taking on the broader patent system as a means to solving this particular pandemic, it's going to take a long time and be awfully, awfully contentious. So I worry about the people that need vaccine today, tomorrow, and next month. So I hope that in having these broader fights around the patent system, that we don't lose sight of what is needed now to get those doses to people.
Well, Thomas Boyke, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My great pleasure. Thanks again for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Thomas Boyke. He's the director of the Global Health Program and a senior fellow for Global Health Economics and Development at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's also a professor of law at Georgetown University and the author of Plagues and the Paradox of Progress, Why the World is Getting Healthier in Worrisome Ways, as well as the founder and managing editor of Think Global Health, an online magazine that examines the ways health shapes economies, societies, and everyday lives around the world. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the voting suppression bill signed today by Florida's Governor DeSantis in a ceremony which excluded the press except for Fox News.
Bye.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Charles Zeldin, who's a professor in the Department of Humanities and Politics at Nova Southeastern University's Halmos College of Arts and Sciences in Florida, an expert on voting rights. His books include Voting Rights on Trial, The Battle for the Black Ballot, Smith versus Allwright, and The Defeat of the Texas All-White Primary, Bush v. Gore, Exposing the Hidden Crisis in American Democracy, the Supreme Court, and Elections. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Zeldin.
Thank you.
So today, Governor DeSantis signed what he says and praised his own legislation he's signing as the strongest election integrity measures in the country. And of course, there was no evidence of any voter fraud. In fact, in the last election, in fact, even Attorney General Barr said there was no problems. And Trump's own Homeland Security Department said it was a very clean and efficient election. In fact, the best or the most secure in memory. So these people are trying to solve a problem that doesn't exist. But the fact that the signing took place with only Fox News allowed in is pretty extraordinary, that DeSantis is basically advertising his partisanship, but also displaying a kind of contempt for the rest of the press. So what's going on there?
Oh, it's worse than just having Fox News be the only news agency there. There were people who were there watching, and they were wearing or holding up signs that said DeSantis 24 or Trump DeSantis 24. So it was completely 100% partisan in that room where he signed this law into being, which basically shows that they're not even trying to pretend that this is bipartisan, that this is balanced. This is a partisan effort to limit who can vote in a way that would help them, they believe, win elections.
Well, I suppose the reason that you had the crowd in the background as a prop holding up pro-DeSantis signs, but also talking about DeSantis and Trump in 2024, that's a reference to the fact that Trump recently said that in 2024 he wanted DeSantis as his running mate.
Yeah, that legally and constitutionally can't happen. You cannot have a president and vice president be from the same state. So either Trump or DeSantis would have to move and establish residency elsewhere before DeSantis could be the vice presidential running mate of Trump in 2024. So I don't know. I doubt that the former president knows this, but it implies that this was more he's throwing out a sop to a popular governor and trying to keep real the possibility that he'll run in 2024 himself, whereas many are looking at DeSantis as the Trump replacement for that election.
Well, that's probably going to be bad news to Mike Pompeo, right?
Pompeo isn't going to like it. Pence isn't going to like it. I think part of the reason why the former president was saying this was, in fact, to play politics with these individuals. While I personally don't think he's going to end up running, whatever the case may be, I think it's very important for the former president to keep open the possibility that he will run until the very last moment, because that gives him a relevancy that is very important to him politically and personally.
Well, it's also a grift, isn't it? He's able to shake down his gullible followers for money. The guy's already put something like $500 million in his pocket in the name of Stop the Steal.
Well, I wasn't going to go there, but yes, it is, in fact, part of the grift, the raising of money. And if you look at the small print when you give money to Stop the Steal or other funds that the president is involved with, it can be used for any purposes that the former president wants to use it. It doesn't have to be used to fight in the courts. It doesn't have to be used even for him to run in 2024. He can use it for whoever he wants. He could even pay it to himself as long as he pays taxes on it.
And again, I'm speaking with Charles Zeldin, who's a professor in the Department of Humanities and Politics at Nova Southeastern University's Halmos College of Arts and Sciences in Florida, an expert on voting rights. His books include Voting Rights on Trial, The Battle for the Black Ballot, Smith v. Allwright, and the Defeat of the Texas All-White Primary, and Bush v. Gore, Exposing the Hidden Crisis in American Democracy, the Supreme Court, and Elections. So, Charles, let's talk a little bit about what Governor DeSantis actually signed into law today. Just in broad strokes, the new laws limit the use of these popular ballot drop-off boxes. It adds identification requirements for voters requesting absentee ballots and requires them to request absentee ballots for each election rather than sign up for them automatically. Is there anything else that I'm missing?
There also, I believe, were provisions that limit the ability to communicate with and to provide services to anyone in line waiting to vote. Effectively, you can't give them water while they're waiting to vote provisions that we saw in Georgia. There was something similar in the bill for here in Florida as well. The really frustrating thing about this is that the governor himself bragged about how effective Florida's election was in 2020. It worked great. All of our hard work paid off. We should be proud. We are the best at this. And the really scary thing is he was right. We had the cleanest election in Florida history in my memory. And that goes back a few years. And all those hard-earned lessons from 2000, from 2004, from, you know, all those hard-earned lessons about what could go wrong, we had taken in, we had found solutions, we had come up with a system that works great, and what is happening now? They're trying to dismantle it. They're taking away the ability of people to vote by mail. They're taking away the ability of people to get their ballot at home, take their time, fill it out carefully and thoughtfully, and then deposit it in a drop box so they know that it gets in time. All of this is infuriating when the system worked so well in 2020, and now they're dismantling it.
Well, obviously DeSantis is ambitious, and he started out, you know, aping Trump and being the Trumpiest of all of the governors there, and that's really saying something. And it's clear that Trump likes him. I mean, they're all kind of lining up. It's kind of embarrassing to see the fealty, the supine fealty that these characters like Senator Ted Cruz, who was just down there paying homage to the dear leader. I mean, it's sickening to watch. But it's working for DeSantis, isn't it? He could probably be an even more effective Trump than Trump himself, and that's really scary.
Yes, and in fact, he's shown a greater ability to apply. Well, a recent editorial from the South Florida Sun Sentinel, which is the local newspaper here in Broward County, described him as effectively acting in dictatorial ways, passing laws and issuing executive orders that basically tell people what they can and can't do, taking away the powers of local government to make decisions for local concerns and local issues. And he's getting away with it. He's pulling it off. He's succeeding.
Well, the worst thing was that the law that he recently signed, with all those police officials standing next to him, that shuts down dissent, and a gathering of three or more people in Florida now is considered a riot. And
all there has to be is a predicating event, a broken window, someone pushed down. And if there's three or more people together, it can be defined as a riot, and individuals can face felony time, even if they themselves did not engage in the violent or illegal activity.
Right, and they rot in jail. They can't get bail. They have to wait en masse before they get a court date. And if there's hundreds of them, then obviously demonstrations tend to have a lot of people. The whole purpose is to punish. And furthermore, there's a provision in the bill that immunizes counter-protesters who drive their vehicles into these protesters. And that's how already happened, of course, in Charlottesville, where the young woman was mowed down and killed by a neo-Nazi.
In their defense, and I'm adamantly against this bill, it doesn't immunize you from criminal liability. It immunizes you from civil liability. So if you hit into me during what you consider to be a riot, I can't sue you for it, but you could be arrested for a criminal act, which would be assault and battery, and possibly even attempted homicide. So it's not a complete protection for the individual who wants to drive into protesters, but it does protect them from being civilly sued by the individuals they harm.
I see. Well, judging by the attitude of the police chief that was standing next to DeSantis when he signed this dreadful bill, I wouldn't count on the police and the law enforcement authorities defending the victim. I think they would defend the perpetrator.
I'm afraid you're probably correct. It would depend on the jurisdiction, but in most parts of Florida, yeah, I don't think the police would be arresting people if in that situation.
So what is it about this guy then? He's obviously, you know, thumbing his nose at the press, and maybe that plays well. It certainly played well for Trump, being against the press and the fake news and all of that stuff. So that seems to be one of the kind of touchstones in Trump land. But is he an authoritarian? I mean, you would think. In fact, I read a piece recently in the Miami Herald written by the Agriculture Commissioner, who's the only Democrat in the cabinet, and she was making the point that DeSantis is acting like the very people that the South Florida Cubans, for example, and other immigrants detest, you know, the Castro brothers, Ortega, Maduro. He's operating out of their dictator's playbook.
Yeah, she made that case, and this is also the case that was made by the Sun Sentinel editorial board just recently. The thing to understand, what's empowering DeSantis is that, A, we are in a time of emergency, which gives him more room to engage in executive orders than if we were not in an emergency period. So COVID has given him a larger playing field to operate on. And two, he's got a supermajority in the legislature. So as long as he's got the backing of the legislature and the party is backing him, he gets the laws passed that reinforce the executive orders that he's implementing. And as long as the Republicans in Florida are happy with what he's doing, there's really no pushback effectively against him until 2022 in the governor's race. And so, we'll have to see what happens there.
Well, but the problem with elections in Florida is that they're incredibly close, but the Republicans usually squeak by. And
yeah, Florida's a place where we have razor-thin elections, but we tend to lean a little bit to the red. The governor won in his, you know, won his last race, his first time as governor, by a very, very small margin, only about 50,000, under 50,000 votes. I think he's hoping that he'll get the 3% win that Donald Trump got in 2020, but I doubt that'll happen, because even if he is, you know, Donald Trump light or Donald Trump the next generation, he's still not Donald Trump. And in a non-presidential year, we can expect to see numbers dropping somewhat. So we'll probably go back again to this really narrow victory for whoever wins the governor's seat. He has the advantage. He's the incumbent. Republicans tend to win by narrow margins. But it's a question of how much he's anchoring people. How many people are frustrated by these laws?
Right, but Charles, isn't it also a question of who runs against him? And They're talking about Val Demings along with the Agriculture Commissioner as well. She's also vying for it, isn't she? Charlie Crist has already entered the race, but I don't think he has much of a chance. So would Val Demings be the strongest candidate against him?
She would definitely be able to drive the Democratic base out. The problem is, to win, she'd also have to reach out and drive the independent voters. And understand that what we have, one-third of our voters are registered independent. Only about 20% of those are truly independent. The remainder either split where they vote Democratic almost all the time or Republican almost all the time. So that 20% in the middle of the independent voters tends to be the deciding factor of who wins. Do they show up, and who do they vote for, and do they vote for that candidate in large enough numbers? I don't know if Val Demings is going to have the statewide reputation necessary to pull it off. There's an old joke here in Florida that you got to lose to win. It's such a big state that in order to get a statewide reputation, you've got to run a statewide election, usually losing it the first time, so people to get to know who you are so you can win the second time.
Mm. What about the Agriculture Commissioner, though? What about her?
Well, she did win a very narrow victory in 2018, but it was a down-ballot race, and some of the people who were voting for governor didn't bother voting in that race. She's got name recognition, but she hasn't been able to do very much as agricultural secretary because all the rest of the government is controlled by the Republicans. So she's right. Sort of a voice in the wilderness. So I agree with you. The problem the Democrats are going to have here in Florida in 2022 in taking on DeSantis is, who do you run who has the rep, the name, and the chops to take him on? And right now, I'm not very hopeful.
Right. And let's hope there's no more sabotage, self-sabotage from the Democrats. Was it the Broward County ballots that were all screwed up and Nelson lost, and he should have won against that dreadful crook who was governor. Paid the biggest fine in history, I think, for Medicare fraud. You know, I mean, it's amazing the characters that succeed in Republican politics in Florida.
Well, welcome to Florida. it's an interesting place to be in, but not always for the best of reasons.
Well, Charles Zeldin, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I'm speaking with Charles Zeldin, who's a professor in the Department of Humanities and Politics at Nova Southeastern University's Halmos College of Arts and Sciences in Florida, an expert on voting rights. His books include Voting Rights on Trial, The Battle for the Black Ballot, Smith versus Allwright, and The Defeat of the Texas All-White Primary, and Bush v. Gore, Exposing the Hidden Crisis in American Democracy, the Supreme Court, and Elections. We're going to take a brief station break and be back discussing how a federal judge is demanding that the DOJ hand over documents that Barr kept secret, along with revelations in the British press that there was a second Steele dossier produced by the FBI during Trump's term.
Yeah! Deep down in Florida. Well, that's a place I long to be. Place I long to be.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is David Rothkopf, who is the CEO of TRG Media, producers of the podcasts including National Security Magazine and Deep State Radio, which Rothkopf hosts. He is a columnist for The Daily Beast and USA Today, and previously he was a senior official in the Clinton administration and also the editor of Foreign Policy magazine and the author of a number of books, including Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council, and The Architects of American Power. And his latest book is Traitor, A History of American Betrayal from Benedict Arnold to Donald Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Rothkopf.
Good to be back.
Well, thanks for joining us, David. And do you have a feeling that the worm is turning here in terms of how Trump skated on all of the inquiries into his relations with Putin and with Russia, and particularly, of course, the Mueller report itself, which was so cleverly mischaracterized by Bill Barr. But now Judge Amy Berman Jackson has accused the Justice Department under Attorney General William Barr of misleading her and Congress about advice he had received from top DOJ officials on whether President Trump should have been charged with obstructing the Russian investigation. So, and she's ordered the release of that particular memo. So what's your sense about whether or not finally there may be some cracks in the armor that has been constructed around Trump to shield his relationship with Putin and with the Russians?
Well, you know, my caveat I begin with is that I've been waiting for this worm to turn for a long time, and it hasn't turned. You know, I mean, every time I thought there was going to be a big break, you know, starting way back, you know, towards the end of the campaign in 2016, but certainly continuing through the Mueller investigation, and then through the impeachment trials, I kind of thought something would happen. Clearly efforts were being made to suppress what we knew. And I think there are some signs that with a new team at DOJ and with time doing what time inevitably does, we are learning more. And so, you know, it's now clear as of a few weeks ago that, we spent so much time talking about collusion, and now, you know, it's very clear that campaign chairman Paul Manafort's right-hand guy, Konstantin Kalimnik, who was a Russian agent, was passing along detailed election data, polling data, directly to Russian intelligence. That, you know, that's collusion. You can't put a question mark next to it. You can't raise your eyebrows. You can't play all the games they played about it. And, you know, one of the things that Mueller was unequivocal about was that there were many instances of obstruction of justice. But then the Department of Justice declined to go after it. And as you point out, thanks to this lawsuit by the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, you know, we now have this ruling that is going to, you know, put that in our hands. I think there are some other things that are floating around out there, whether it's, you know, reports of another dossier by the gentleman who produced the first one, or just my sense that, you know, we're going to start hitting, you know, memoir season pretty soon. And from what I've heard from some of the things that are coming, we're likely to get some more details than those.
Well, on the point that you made, David, about Kalimnik, who worked for Manafort and who Manafort gave really important election data, particularly involving the three critical states that Trump won, that was passed on to Russian intelligence. We learned that recently. And Andrew Weissman, who was the number two under Mueller, recently said, had we had that information when we were doing the Mueller report, that would have been the smoking gun we were looking for. So again, it's a little late, but I don't think it's going to penetrate the consciousness of the Trump followers. But you mentioned the other possibility, and that is this report that just came out in the UK Telegraph, which of course has always been a conduit for leaks from MI6, that Christopher Steele, the author of the original dossier that became controversial but was never thoroughly disproved or even partially disproved, he was a former MI6 spy and in charge of the Russian desk. And now we're learning that he actually continued working for the FBI in spite of all the controversy and produced a second dossier for the FBI on Donald Trump while Trump was in the White House. And according to this report in the British UK Telegraph, Steele filed a series of intelligence reports to US authorities during the Trump presidency, including information concerning alleged sexual exploits. So And that, of course, relates to the famous pee-pee tape with the prostitutes in the hotel in Moscow in 2013 during Trump's visit there for the Miss Universe competition. So I guess that's obviously explosive, and that was the very thing that people described as being over the top in the original Steele report, but it sounds like Steele's doubled down on that.
Yeah, you know, I have not the slightest interest in Trump's sex life, and in fact, try to think of it as little as possible.
I think that's wise.
But, yeah, yeah.
I don't want to go there either. Thank you very much.
I don't want to go there either. The only reason it might be relevant is as leverage over Trump. And I think it's salient in that respect because, you know, whatever the political debate may be in the United States, and I think we're so numb to it after, you know, nearly 5 years of you know, going back into the 2016 campaign through now, of discussing Trump and Russia, there are really only two possibilities. One, Trump knowingly worked with the Russian government, contrary to U.S. interests, in order to help himself get elected and then stay in power. Or Trump put himself in a position where he could be helped by the Russians and subsequently defended them and rewarded them for their support for him. There is no possibility that he wasn't working with them, that his team wasn't working with them, because we know they were. There is no possibility that he did not obstruct justice on their behalf or reward them in the policy world, because we know he did. And I think there is some degree of interest to know what they had on him and whether he knew they had what they had on him, because that will help us to determine whether somebody said to him at one point or another, hey, buddy, you know, you better go along with the Russians here. You're going to have a problem. Or he did it for another reason, or he was just being used by them because he's such a venal, transactional, shallow, short-sighted guy. And I think, you know, finding out the motivation is fine. But, you know, to me, what's more important is the guy betrayed the country and has not been held accountable for it. And the couple of people who were held accountable for it, he let off the hook, Manafort, Stone, and a bunch of the people who were responsible for it, like Don Jr. and others, have managed to dodge accountability. And I don't think as a country we can actually move forward and beyond the Trump era until those people are held accountable.
Well, it seems like the two things that we've been talking about here, the second Steele dossier and the earlier stuff that you mentioned, David, about Konstantin Kilimnik, which Andrew Weissman again suggested, had they known that during the Mueller report period, it would have been the smoking gun they were looking for in terms of collusion. There seems that these two are related in the sense that apparently this second dossier has many more details on Manafort's Russian contacts, and in also more details about Konstantin Kilimnik, who is an officer with the GRU, Russian military intelligence. I don't know whether this has led to the fact that the FBI has offered a $250,000 reward for information leading to the arrest of Konstantin Kilimnik, and the U.S. Treasury has sanctioned him, describing him as a known Russian intelligence service agent. So these two things may well be connected.
Yeah, and you know what else is connected? You know, the FBI just raided Rudy Giuliani's house because he was involved in efforts in Ukraine, possibly to get rid of the U.S. ambassador there, possibly to get dirt on Biden. And those efforts in Ukraine were undoubtedly directly linked also to Russian intelligence and Russian efforts to produce to support Trump, but also potentially to weaken government in Ukraine or U.S. relations with Ukraine or U.S. support for Ukraine. And so, you know, this is the net is much bigger than any one of these things. It's not just about getting data and getting help with the campaign. It's not just about obstruction of justice. It's not just about Kalimnik or Oleg Deripaska, the oligarch of, you know, that sort of owned Paul Manafort. It's not just about Trump's aspirations for, you know, building a Trump Tower in Moscow, or just about what happened in Ukraine, or any support the Russians might have given in the course of the 2020 election, or the rewards that Trump gave to the Russians along the way. It's all those things. It is a big friggin' conspiracy that involves lots and lots of people at a very high level. The biggest, you know, high-level betrayal of the country in American history. And we've still got half the country who says, oh, no, that didn't even happen. You know, there literally half of America has got their head in the sand. And you've got people in the Republican Party right now, you know, the Ron Johnsons of this world, who, like Giuliani, were, you know, given warnings what the Russians were up to, and who are perfectly happy, so long as they gain power from it, to defend Russia, defend Putin, advance the agenda of the Kremlin and the GRU, even if it's contrary to U.S. interests. And that's going on right now. You know, that's not last year's news.
Well, when you've got 7 out of 10 Republicans believing that Trump won the election and that Biden is not a legitimate president, and believing this revisionist history about the storming of the Capitol on January the 6th being a love fest where the Trump supporters were hugging and kissing the police and all the violence was conducted by Antifa. I mean, I'd say, Houston, we have a problem here. And the problem might be with the American people, or at least a big chunk of them. I don't understand how they could be so beguiled by this dreadful, fraudulent, disgraceful man who's both a criminal and, I believe, a traitor.
They're, you know, I don't know that they are beguiled by this guy. I mean, you know, this is, you know, kind of the most repulsive human being that has been in American public life in memory by any measure, his personal behavior, his personal appearance, his personal, you know, code of ethics or lack thereof, the way he treats his family, corruption in his administration, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think Trump has won this support because it's in the interests of the supporters to, you know, that they're having a chance to sort of unify behind somebody who's actually articulating, you know, the things that really motivate them, and that is racism, fear of demographic change in the United States, fear of losing the power that they feel that they're entitled to within the United States government, other things that have been sort of unspoken, less spoken in the past. We're also reaching a point of criticality in a bunch of these issues. And you know, I think a lot of these people also have had 40 years since Ronald Reagan of being preached at by one of the two major political parties in the United States that the government is evil, that government is bad, you know, to the point that that is a matter of faith. And so having somebody who is willing to be, who appears to be outside that system, contrary to it and inflammatory to it, suits them, you know. And so, you know, I don't attribute this phenomenon of 70% of the Republican Party denying the truth and embracing Trump purely to Trump. I think it's something that has happened over decades, you know, in a drift within the party. But, you know, as you sort of implied in your question, that doesn't really matter. If 70% of the Republican Party is willing to reject the facts, is willing to overlook the fact that the last president of the United States betrayed the country, that he was by any definition a traitor, as I, you know, discussed in the last book, that's hugely problematic for the country, and it's hugely problematic for democracy in the country. And this has not worked out yet. And if the Republicans gain back the House and the Senate, or the House or the Senate in 2022, or win back the White House in 2024, we're going to look at this moment of the high competence and achievement of Joe Biden as, you know, illusory, you know, and the world is going to look at it that way. They're going to say, no, America has gone off the deep end. You know, this is one of these countries that succumbed to right-wing populist ethno-nationalism like Brazil, Mexico, India, Russia, China.
Turkey. So just in closing, in the last minute here, David, you mentioned Rudy Giuliani and his troubles. Adam Schiff, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, predicted that Rudy Giuliani would end up in jail. What's your prediction?
Look, I have a lot of respect for Adam Schiff, and Adam Schiff does not say stuff like that lightly. He is a very thoughtful guy who understands the law and how it works. There's every reason to believe Rudy Giuliani should end up in jail, whether it's for, you know, FARA violations or something more serious. I'm not sure what he might be convicted of, but he has certainly been at the right hand of Trump while Trump was actively seeking both to collaborate with the Russians and to dismantle democracy in America. And so if he ends up in jail, you know, couldn't happen to a nicer guy.
Well, David Rothkopf, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Stay well.
Thank you, David. And again, I've been speaking with David Rothkopf, who's the CEO of TRG Media, producers of the podcasts, including National Security Magazine and Deep State Radio, which Rothkopf hosts. Previously was a senior official in the Clinton administration, also the editor of Foreign Policy Magazine. He's now a columnist for The Daily Beast and for USA Today. And he's the author of many books, including Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and The Architects of American Power. And his latest book is Traitor, A History of American Betrayal from Benedict Arnold to Donald Trump. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. And this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate. where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.